Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by the Yale Law School. Martha Minow, Harvard Law School Dean and Jeremiah Smith Jr. Professor of Law, gave the Robert M. Cover Lecture in Law and Religion at Yale Law School on March 22, 2010. The lecture is entitled, Confronting the Seduction of Choice, Law, Education, and American Pluralism.
Five distinct moments of legal, political, and cultural conflict over schooling in the United States have offered choice as the solution. It's a seductive frame. At times it obstructs, and at other times it serves equal opportunity, anti-racism, tolerance, and multiculturalism. The captivating appeal of the rhetoric of choice obscures these shifts and masks the influence of choice policies on the character of schools, social identity, and policy. I examined the topic inspired by Robert Cover's ruthless and visionary challenge to any simple solution to the fact of our multiplicity. No single umbrella can contain our conflicting values, and certainly not something as apparently innocuous as choice. And yet choice offers a tempting avenue for channeling or papering over deep conflicts over religion, race, immigration, and national identity, and even the meaning and content of school choices, as I will explore with you today. The honor to speak of this here, where I first studied and debated law, in fact, in this room, my contracts class, to be here with Dean Post, my dear friend and esteemed colleague since our student days, I have stories, and to be with this amazing community means so much to me. I am touched more than I can say by the opportunity to be here with old and new friends, and with Avi and Arnold and Donna, and under the auspices of the Robert M. Cover Lectureship in Law and Religion. My project reflects some of Bob Cover's preoccupations. I actually think all the time about the questions that he posed. In a seminar room, Bob Cover was gentle, soft-spoken, ruminative. Sometimes he mumbled. In his writing, he was ferocious, probing, and provocative. This contrast mirrors his extraordinary capacity to grasp and embrace deep tensions and contradictions in law and in life. He embraced both unity and pluralism. He demanded recognition of multiple sources of norms, even as he searched for an organizing framework to relate liberal values and illiberal communities. He kept a steady eye on the illiberalism tolerated and even enabled by liberal tolerance itself. He managed to conceal his addiction to baseball to most but his closest friends by treating its players as metaphors for Supreme Court justices. He returned again and again to history for stories of struggle and paths opened but not taken. This lectureship honoring Robert Cover so aptly spotlights historical, philosophical, sociological, and literary perspectives on law and religion because the plural identities and modalities match his own multidisciplinary deployment of game theory, Talmudic tales, literary criticism, engineering texts, playfulness, classics from ancient Greece, and more. His search for meaning ensured the vibrancy and endurance of his scholarship and his activism. He was a scholar of scholars, constantly alert to the pains of the world. So inspired and humbled by his example, I will tell a story of unintended consequences and paradoxes in struggles over unity and difference, with contests over law and religion circling around school choice. The slogan, school choice in this country, has long signaled support for parochial, religious schools. It has also been a vessel, though big enough to hold resistance to school desegregation, and also a tactic for achieving it. School choice resonates with the liberal value of autonomy and the market conception of consumer sovereignty. In the abstract, giving parents the opportunity to choose for their kids looks like a boost to freedom and an elimination of the restrictions imposed by a system assigning students to government-run schools based on the neighborhood they live in. What's not to like about choice? Certainly, sitting here in the Yale Law School, where its own educational program celebrates student choice, as do most colleges, choice is good. Choice is American. But I'm dealing here with elementary school, middle school, and high school, so already things get complicated. In light of existing preferences and inequalities, the option of private schooling and public subsidies for school vouchers, magnet schools, and charter schools can easily undermine integration along lines of race, class, gender, and disability, unless the choice plans include deliberate dimensions of integration. The polity, our demos, needs to prepare the next generation, not just for jobs, but also for democracy and citizenship. And that makes schooling a crucial collective good, not necessarily well guided by individual family decisions. So, choice has framed five pivotal moments in American schooling. I'm going to describe these five moments, and I'm going to meditate on them. The first is the 1920s fight over Americanization. The second, private school options and freedom of choice plans used by whites to bypass court-ordered racial desegregation in the 1950s and 60s. Third, the turn to magnet schools and other forms of public school choice in pursuit of racial desegregation from 1970 until the Supreme Court curbed such efforts not very long ago. Fourth, the constitutional campaign to approve publicly financed vouchers to pay for religious schoolings, reaching fruition in 2002. And finally, the contemporary push for charter schools. The rhetoric of choice has appealed at times to religious free exercise, to individual autonomy, to free market values, to American multiculturalism, and to ideological neutrality. The rhetoric of choice has also papered over conflicts over immigration, religion, race, and national identity. While choice in this regard may have much to commend it, it should not be used to conceal unfairness or to obstruct racial equality or genuine debates over American identity. This look into five moments offers cautionary lessons and tools, I hope, for interrogating choice options now and in the future. So, the first moment. In the early 20th century, nativist anxieties about waves of immigrants and Bolshevism fueled movements to Americanize children of newcomers. These sentiments took an extreme form in Oregon, where groups like the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, and the Federated Patriotic Societies, the Scottish Rite Masons, pushed not just for compulsory schooling, a movement around the country, but also required attendance solely at public schools. The reformers sounded white supremacist, anti-Catholic, and anti-Semitic tones while pushing assimilation of immigrants into American culture, by which they meant Protestant culture. The relative homogeneity of Oregon may have contributed to the success of this initiative, even as it in turn built a coalition among civil libertarians, African Americans, Catholics, and Jews who organized to challenge the law. Operators of two private schools, the Catholic Society of Sisters of the Holy Name of Jesus and Mary and the Hill Military Academy, an interesting coalition here, came together to challenge the law, and the United States Supreme Court struck it down. Arising in the era of Lochner versus New York, the case fell within the court's view that government could not take private property in a way that destroys people's ability to earn a living. The state could not put private schools out of business. But as the private property theme lost its appeal, the court's asides respecting parental choice and pluralism over the decades have acquired reverence and placed Pierce versus Society of Sisters as a key precedent not only for religious freedom and parental rights, but also fundamental privacy, including a woman's right to choose to terminate a pregnancy. Justice James McReynolds' memorable sentence are the most quoted from the case. He said, "The child is not the mere creature of the state. Those who nurture him and direct his destiny have the right, coupled with the high duty, to recognize and prepare him for additional obligations." The decision has ever since accorded constitutional protection to parental choice of parochial and other private schooling, but the decision has also produced a system in which only public schools receive public funding, leaving parental choice of private schooling to either private philanthropy or to families with economic resources. Hence, although there remains no federal constitutional right to an education, there is a constitutional right of parents to select a private education if they can pay for it. On the trail of fights over public power and religion, Pierce illustrates a pattern. It's a pattern of constitutional challenge to policies framed as if they're universal, but exposed to exclude or subordinate members of minorities, here religious minorities. And so the universal compulsory schooling was viewed as actually onerous to the Catholic families who viewed the public schools as actually Protestant. Preserving choice over education, Pierce versus Society of Sisters at the same time gave rise to decades of efforts by parents seeking public funding for religious schooling. And so for 75 years, we've had religious organizations organizing legislation, constitutional challenges, and this early chapter well exemplifies how the notion of school choice reflected but also submerged tensions over national identity and protected minority groups while veiling unequal treatment. Even as Pierce established the option of private schooling as constitutionally protected, it entrenched this system of two tiers of schooling, with public financing for one and private schools depending on user fees or philanthropy. The second moment offered the seduction of school choice as a way to avoid racial desegregation. Private schooling became an avenue for avoiding court-ordered school desegregation in the wake of Brown v. Board of Education. And so did public school plans, ostensibly allowing students to transfer, but practically producing literally no movement between historically black and historically white schools. So in 1955, in the wake of Brown, free market economist Milton Friedman, you heard of him, he developed an academic justification for school choice. Interesting year to do it, 1955. His argument connected the liberal value of autonomy to the economic notion of consumer sovereignty. And though he didn't address the degree of freedom or coercion affecting actual choices of in practice, Friedman, who'd already won the John Bates Clark Medal for outstanding achievement in economics for someone under 40, applied microeconomics theory and justified consumer choice among competing providers in order to propel improvement of schooling. This did require viewing school as a product of consumption. And preserving the state's role in dispersing funds was a little bit inconsistent with his private market ideology. Friedman consistently emphasized, though, that vouchers would promote a free society. He did think, though, that it should still be publicly funded because the community needs educated people. Now, trying to figure out the relationship between Milton Friedman's proposal and racial desegregation is hampered by limited evidence. 50 years after the case, he said, looking back on it, that he had not been affected at all by contemporaneous incidents. He said he drafted the paper before he learned that there were several southern states exploring private schools with public funding as a way to evade the Supreme Court's ruling against segregation. In the actual publication itself, which I had the fun of going back to read, Friedman wrote that he deplored racial prejudice, and he actually thought that the risk of exacerbating class differences would count against his proposal. But he reasoned that government-forced desegregation is only slightly less objectionable than government-forced segregation, and publicly funded parental choice of schools struck him as the best solution for all of the issues of racial segregation and quality schooling. School choice practices did spring up as a form of resistance by white Southerners who didn't want to desegregate. Organizations cropped up across the South to fight the implementation of Brown, and they effectively mobilized threats of retaliation against anyone who advocated integration. In Virginia, the legislature went so far as to cut off public funds for any racially integrated school, and the governor decided to close all the schools rather than to integrate them. The NAACP filed challenge, ultimately, the state courts and the federal courts rejected the school closings, and the state legislature responded by repealing compulsory schooling. That was a great solution. And the local authorities then closed all the schools in the Prince Edward County in 1959. Private schools cropped up. They were supported by state tuition grants and county tax credits, and they opened their doors to white children. This was one of many times and places when private schools became associated with resistance to desegregation. In this extreme instance, the county's 1,700 black children had no educational opportunities for 5 years. Although the neighboring Norfolk Catholic High School integrated voluntarily and without incident. In Prince Edwards County, the local NAACP organization tried to organize alternative informal schooling for black students while pursuing a challenge in court. And 10 years later, 10 years after Brown v. Board, the Supreme Court actually found, and I quote, closing the Prince Edward schools and meanwhile contributing to the support of the private segregated white schools that took their place, denied petitioners the equal protection of the laws, and the court in this famous case declared that the time for deliberate speed has run out. But school choice had not been ended as an end run around desegregation. School authorities in many communities then adopted what they called freedom of choice plans, developed ostensibly to implement desegregation, but it became a euphemism for resurgent racial separation. Some public systems simply allowed students to opt out of any desegregated school. That was called school choice. One plan assigned students to their previously segregated schools and said anyone could transfer. No one did. White families almost uniformly selected the historically white schools. Blacks almost uniformly stayed in the black schools. I don't think it was school choice entirely. I think that there was a lot of threat of vigilante violence for anyone who did try to cross the color line. The Supreme Court in 1968 rejected the freedom of choice plans as insufficient to meet the district's obligation to desegregate. It was an era when a court was able to look behind a label and say, what's really going on? It shouldn't be surprising, though, to see that in many quarters, school choice has been tainted as an anti-desegregation tactic. The episode shows just how freedom and choice can be empty phrases when the underlying structures of opportunity and attitudes remain unchanged. Just as Anatole France famously pointed out how the majestic equality of the law forbids alike the rich and the poor to sleep under the bridges, to beg in the streets, and to steal bread, voluntary transfers from schools that are both racially segregated and unequal produce equality only in the most superficial sense. And when there's the threat of vigilante violence against anyone who would cross the color line, it really was a joke. So we come to the third moment. The third moment tempted liberals and progressives to use school choice initiatives in the 1970s and 80s to secure racial desegregation. An initial experiment with school vouchers in Alum Rock, California, had federal funding with this hope, but it failed. And the RAND Corporation issued a report that it kind of disappointed people about the prospects of school choice. Nonetheless, courts, notably the court in the district court in Boston, other courts as well, started to issue school desegregation plans that had school choice dimensions and included a kind of magnet school idea, try to make the schools attractive, and then have racial-based categories so that you can keep track of who's admitted to schools and thereby try to, with this kind of soft paternalism, entice white parents to choose public urban schools and endow them with special programs and draw black and Hispanic and immigrant students to these schools out of their neighborhood schools. So public school systems in Dallas, Richmond, Boston use magnet schools. And these sometimes offered special resources, sometimes exam schools. But here, there were new difficulties. As a device to promote racial balance in previously segregated or isolated schools, the magnet programs could produce diverse enrollments while reducing diversity in the non-magnet schools. Or they could attract resources to the frustration of neighborhood schools that didn't get these extra resources. Or they could, in fact, create wonderful schools as a scarce commodity, leaving the rest of the schools not so good. More seriously, the defect in this strategy arose with the use of racial categories issued by courts. It laid the seeds for the resentment that led to the movement that led to the attack on affirmative action in colleges and universities, and yes, in K through 12 education. In 1995, the magnet schools faced two major legal setbacks. The Supreme Court rejected the court-ordered desegregation plan for Kansas City, Missouri, that was enacted after the court found that race segregation had persisted for a century, and the white flight from the city was leaving this district with 68% black students. So as a remedy, the court came up with a plan. Why don't we try to attract the white kids back from the suburbs? We'll make all of the schools in the system magnet schools. That was the plan. And the Supreme Court said no. Trying to attract students from outside the district fell outside the mandate to remedy segregation. And the minute the court issued its decision, 40% of the suburban students who had planned to enroll in the city schools withdrew. 1995 created another second setback for magnet schools in Boston. Sarah Westman, a white ninth grader, filed a suit against the magnet school in Boston, one of the three exam schools, for reserving slots for African Americans and Hispanics. The exam schools were the jewel of the public school system. These were in a system that was actually not a very good public school system. There were a couple of wonderful schools. How many of you went to exam schools? Come on, you did. Magnet schools? Nobody here? Okay, we'll talk later. Okay. These competitive admission schools typically offer pretty exceptional academic opportunities or better ones and avenues to college. But by having some seats set aside on the basis of race, these public schools fell right in the path of the anti-affirmative action movement. And the Supreme Court, culminating in the Supreme Court's rejection of the use of voluntary racial integration in public middle and elementary and high schools in the parents-involved case. The court in that case, very recently forbade official use of individual students' racial identities to ensure racial balance, absent a prior finding of intentional race discrimination. And then you put it together with the Kansas City case, you can't use it even where you did have a direct finding of discrimination, so basically you can't use it. It's a problem. The temptation to use school choice to produce racial integration not only failed legally, it fueled campaigns against affirmative action, and it obscured the continuing patterns of unequal access to test preparation and information used in the school system. So just a little anecdote that gets lost in this story. The Boston Latin exam school that was the subject of the litigation, the school department disclosed that most of the students admitted had taken the admission test twice, and all but six of the 115 students who had taken the admission test twice came from private schools. This fact reinforced complaints that it was higher income families that were sending their children to private school, and that was the feeder for the exam school system. So this was supposed to be great equal opportunity, and it really wasn't. That little fact got lost as everyone became preoccupied with race. Fourth seductive moment brings to the fore religious schools and the debates over public funding. This was the seed that was planted at the time of Pierce. The resentment that private schools, religious schools, didn't get public funding. Critics and supporters alike, though, have noted for decades that school choice initiatives would face constitutional challenge if they directed public dollars to private religious schools. After all, courts had ruled for decades that the Establishment Clause is violated when states reimburse public schools for reimburse private schools for secular textbooks and teacher salaries, or when they authorize tax credits or deductions for tuition for non-public schools. Also impermissible, said the courts, were deployments of public school staff to go on the site of a religious school to provide instruction or testing. And these decisions stood in the way of public vouchers to pay for religious schooling. It also prompted unusual bedfellows for change. The doctrine, in fact, was inconsistent. The Supreme Court had actually allowed public aid to students enrolled in religious schools if the public school personnel offered standardized tests and speech instruction, but not other kinds of services. It authorized public reimbursement for maps, but not textbooks, and for buses to go on field trips, but not every day. So it wasn't a very consistent set of cases. It was an opportunity waiting for litigants to challenge, and the litigants did challenge it. Advocates seeking school choice joined forces with others who found the government's treatment of government aid to religion unfair and unpredictable. There were social conservatives who found suddenly that market rhetoric was congenial if it would support public aid to religious schools, and there were secular liberals who opposed choice as a code for public aid to religion, or undue pressure on poor families to select religious schools, or as an attack on critical thinking and the integrative missions of public schooling. And here's a moment of great legal imagination. Advocates reimagined the terms on which these issues should be analyzed. Michael McConnell, my co-clerk, my friend, before he was a judge, when he was a law professor, he was an advocate, and he pursued a line of precedents that inch by inch opened up public schools to religion, first of all, in after-school programs, and then in publications, and then in holiday celebrations. And the strategy that succeeded rhetorically and legally was to switch from talking about the Establishment Clause altogether and to talk about the First Amendment, to talk about viewpoint discrimination. And here, the legacy of Brown v. Board is just uncanny, because by claiming discrimination, the religious schools could suddenly now make a case that they were being denied public funding. And that's the strategy that was picked up by Clint Bullock. Clint Bullock organized a litigation campaign in the late 80s to justify public financing of private school vouchers. Now, who's Clint Bullock? Anybody here know Clint Bullock? He got his professional start with the Mountain States Legal Services Foundation, which was funded by conservative businessman Joseph Kors. It was led by James Watt. These are names nobody here knows, but I know them. James Watt later headed the Department of Interior under President Ronald Reagan. He's the one who thought that trees caused pollution. Okay, rings a bell. Good. Bullock then went from that job to go work for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission under a man named Clarence Thomas. Maybe you've heard of him. And Bullock and his colleagues developed a plan to launch a conservative public interest law firm that would mimic the NAACP. And his plan, though he had different aims, was to pursue libertarian goals, but also with the curious feature of seeking public funding for the libertarian goals. So he said he wanted to copy the NAACP by pursuing, and these are his words, a principled, incremental, long-term agenda expressing the cause in the most universal possible terms and forging non-traditional allegiances. And he did, and he succeeded. So departing from the usual conservative criticism of judicial activism, Bolick urged judicial activism. He went to these conservative foundations and said, no, judicial activism is good. We just have to get the right judges. And he advocated a strategy of representing low-income parents to place urban public schools on trial, these are his words, and clearly identified choice as a low-income empowerment solution. He later explained success in advancing school choice would build support for economic liberty and private property rights, and maybe delegitimate the public schools. Initially, he failed. Over time, he and his movement succeeded. State Supreme Courts, Wisconsin, Ohio, Arizona, upheld public payment for religious school vouchers. In 1997, he wrote a friend of the court brief in a case where the Supreme Court of the United States overruled prior decisions and allowed public employees to provide services on the campuses of religious schools. And that decision paved the way for the big win in 2002 in Zelman versus Simmons-Harris, where the Supreme Court approved a voucher plan in Cleveland, Ohio, that offered financial assistance to low-income parents to select religious schools from among a choice of elementary, public, and private schools. Now, look, the situation in Cleveland was a disaster. The schools in the public system in the city were terrible. And including religious schools as an option was the first good thing in the lives of many of these young children, mostly of color, mostly poor. And that largely was the music of the argument made before the Supreme Court, that the voucher plan would work because it would open up opportunities to low-income kids of color. It also worked with the argument that it wasn't the government that would be picking the private religious schools, it would be parents. And therefore, we broke the circuit. There was no government payment of religion. It was parents who were picking with public money. Justice Clarence Thomas, who'd been promoted by this time to the Supreme Court and took Justice Thurgood Marshall's place as the sole African American on the court, he wrote quite an interesting opinion. He distinguished Cleveland's voucher program, he felt he had to, from the freedom of choice plans that were used to avoid school desegregation. He noted the irony that the choice plans had promoted white flight and segregation at the time of Brown. But he emphasized that 50 years later, school choice represented perhaps the only avenue for better opportunities for poor kids of color in a city like Cleveland, otherwise trapped in failing public schools. And so now it's lawful. Public dollars can pay for private religious schools. And with that come four new challenges. First, publicly funded school vouchers risk perpetuating unequal treatment, particularly for poor kids of color, because they and their parents may not be able to take advantage of the private school options. School choice will remain scarce, very few seats in these schools, and parents with financial means or savvy will be the ones most likely to benefit. Second, school vouchers risk skimming from public schools the most engaged families of whatever color or class, leaving the rest of the students in inadequate schools without political clout or the active monitoring of engaged parents. Third, school vouchers risk pressuring students to attend schools not of their own religion and pressuring religious schools to modify their practices to suit the government funder. And fourth, and in my view, the most serious risk, is that school voucher programs offer the illusion of choice, but in fact remain confined profoundly. Why? Because not a single one has crossed the border between city and suburb. The origin of this district boundary problem doesn't stem from school choice itself, but school choice helps to obscure it, making it seem like people have choices when they have no access, actually, to the very good suburban public schools. And then here comes the biggest surprise of all. Big win, 2002. Republican Party very thrilled, lots of these conservative groups very thrilled. The voucher movement dies. Why? Given the constitutional green light, what happened? The political movement absolutely failed. And I would suggest to you, it's exactly the same border between city and suburb that explains it. The suburban parents don't want school vouchers. They like their public schools, thank you, and they certainly don't want anyone else coming in. It's also true that teachers' unions helped put the brakes on the voucher movement. For a variety of reasons, voters started defeating statewide school choice referenda, and none of the results were close. By 2010, public vouchers to support private schooling have receded from the public stage. One of President Obama's first acts was to end the voucher experiment in the District of Columbia. And this leaves entrepreneurial school reformers looking for another way to pursue school choice. And that brings us to the current and fifth moment. School choice still has great resonance, and there are lots of people very ginned up and excited about it. And so the new development is to take that idea of magnet schools and expand it, and the name is charter schools. Anybody here go to a charter school? No. Where did you guys go to school? All right. So charter schools started in Minnesota and really just about 15 years ago, and they are catching on like wildfire. These are public schools. They're authorized by statute or ordinance. They provide public money for entrepreneurial groups of teachers or parents to create their own schools around their own purposes. And this could be a great moment of truth about what kinds of schools are encouraged or allowed. There are also school choice efforts within public systems, like New York City or like Cambridge, Massachusetts, where, again, local schools develop a special identity and they draw students from around the district. In most places, the charter schools are highly regulated, though some are able to bypass local collective bargaining rules. And although only about 5% of all public school students now attend charter schools, the number of charter schools is growing rapidly. It grew 11% last year. In New Orleans, after the Katrina disaster, the public school system was destroyed. The federal government poured $24 million into the city, all charter schools. All charter schools. So New Orleans school system is charter schools, and they're actually doing much better. They've attracted talented teachers and administrators from around the country. School choice permeates whole school systems like Cambridge, Massachusetts. Every student has to apply to go to a school. A little shock as a parent to find out there was no such thing as a neighborhood school, but there isn't. New York City, the education department, go to the website. It touts school choice. The high schools include career and technical schools, charter schools, small learning communities, small schools partnering with nonprofit organizations, specialized high schools, transfer schools that offer personalized attention to dropouts. You know, New York public schools include the Harvey Milk School, designated for, though not limited to, gay, lesbian, and bisexual and transgender teens. It includes a middle school devoted to computer game design. It's a really interesting world, the New York City school system. School choice can produce varied, vibrant, successful schools, but here's the new seduction. They can yield more schools that are separated by race, ethnicity, language, gender, disability, or other traits, because the very framework of choice invites the entrepreneurs to use these categories as the way to attract people. School choice specialized by student identity can have strengths, but it can have drawbacks. And the decision about how much public education should tilt in their direction deserves collective decision making, not just private family choice. But that's what we have. We have private family choice. The seductive possibility of school choice authorizes many, many interesting schools. And maybe this is producing a kind of difference and an abrasive difference that Professor Heather Gerken calls second-order diversity, enabling an institutional practice that involves variation if you just look across the schools, even though within the schools there's maybe increasing homogeneity. Such specialized settings may also reflect deep and considered preferences, but they may instead result from an echo chamber. An effect studied by Cass Sunstein, who suggested people use enclaves, shorthand, and even stereotypes when they're bombarded with choices that are hard to sort through. Expressing tolerance or appreciation at some level, a system that enables special identity schools can also enable a focal point for particular communities, and it can also produce less mixing of kids from different backgrounds. So let me give you some examples. Hispanic parents disproportionately select charter schools with names that sound Hispanic. So the Cesar Chavez Academy in Pueblo City, Colorado is an example. Specialized curricular programs also appeal to other groups, such as Hmong or Somali immigrants. Hawaii authorized charter schools in 2001. Over half of them pursue Native Hawaiian educational programs, culture, and language. I had to go visit them and check it out. The Native Hawaiians comprise, as it turns out, 93% of the enrollment in the charter schools, the Native Hawaiian charter schools in Hawaii, even though Native Hawaiians in Hawaii as a whole are less than 26% of the students. Parents are often drawn to schools organized around a theme that celebrates their own cultural heritage. Illinois has the Betty Shabazz International Charter School, named for an advocate for African Americans, designed to offer cultural affirmation of African Americans across the curriculum. Studies show an increase in racially segregated schools all across Michigan. And why? It's traced to charter schools, because black families are picking charter schools as alternatives to the mainstream schools and drawing their population away from the mainstream schools. Minority students exited conventional Minneapolis schools through choice options that have, again, tilted the public system to be much more white. Charter schools can attract black families who feel racially isolated or disenfranchised by the traditional public schools. And in fact, what's so kind of paradoxical is that charter schools could promote racial integration if they picked a topic or a theme that actually attracted people from different backgrounds, as opposed to signaling special identity purposes. Just consider this example. Two schools, each charter schools, same town, Arizona. One of them is called the Triumphant Learning Center, and the other one is called Los Molinos Academy. Each of them offers a college preparatory curriculum. Yet by their names and their locations, who their founders are, what the expectations are for parental involvement, and the meals that they advertise that they offer, they signal directly Triumphant Learning Center appeals to white families and it has a 90% white enrollment, whereas Los Molinos Academy appeals to Hispanic and Catholic students and it has a 53% Hispanic population, same town. Schools with specialized ethnic, cultural, or bilingual programs are likely to reduce racial mixing absent concerted efforts to generate diverse enrollments. More choice does not always mean diversity, at least not within individual schools. And instead, perhaps even because of choice, families may seek enclaves and use identity categories to simplify their choices. It requires something more than choice if you think that mixing kids of different backgrounds is important. It requires planning. It requires regulation. Take Arabic language schools. Certainly terribly important function of schoolings in America right now. We should have many, many people learning Arabic. And an Arabic language school could facilitate, preparation for careers in diplomacy, in the military. Depends how it's done. So Minneapolis and St. Paul established the Twin City International Elementary and Middle Schools charter schools as a response, and this is from the official website, to desires of a particular immigrant community. The school website explains, was founded by educational leaders in the East African community. The schools strive to provide a quality academic program in a culturally sensitive setting for immigrant and refugee children. This is not a school designed to mix kids. This is a school that teaches Arabic, and it's for Somali refugee kids. And it's 100% Somali refugee kids. The dress code permits head coverings and all the girls pictured on the website wear hijabs. You could have a very different idea. The Arabic language school in New York City actually has about 50% of the kids speak Arabic at home, 50% don't. They had a little problem when they had a principal who said something about what an intifada is, and then she got fired, and then they put a Jewish woman as the principal. So they've had some interesting challenges. New Jersey, meantime, created a Hebrew language immersion school as a public school. Florida created a Hebrew language immersion school. Now, they had a problem because they put a rabbi at the head of the school, and their texts seemed to be a little bit religiously oriented. So they've had a renovation, and they now don't have a rabbi as a head, and they've changed their schools, but it exists. And there's a movement now to create a string of Hebrew language charter schools across New Jersey. Charter legislation in some states allow faith leaders to sit on the governing boards and accommodate students' religious school schedules. One school has been so controversial that in policy discussions, it is known by a pseudonym. It's called the Valley Charter School. I myself don't know its real name. It was launched in 1994 to supplement the education of homeschooled children in California. Its parents are all conservative Christians. The program is entirely composed of self-selected families that use the device of the charter school to get public funds to pay for homeschooling. Special identity schools are cropping up also for students with disabilities. Such schools may offer valuable accommodation, but they also depart from what is the presumption in the law that students should be mainstreamed if they're disabled with students who are not mainstreamed. You create a charter school that says, we specialize in education for students with attention deficit disorder, and guess what? You get an enrollment of students with attention deficit disorder. You create a school that says, we specialize in accommodating students who are autistic. Guess what? You get an enrollment of autistic students. Now, these may be wonderful programs, but they certainly depart without any discussion publicly from the public commitment in federal law and state law to mainstream kids with disabilities. Florida has such schools. Nevada does as well. This seems to be a trend. Even though only 71 of the 3,000 charter schools across the country in 2008 were designed specifically for students with disabilities, 34 of them were chartered the year before. So there's an escalation going on here. Special identity schools can also be single-sex schools. And the Bush administration made single-sex schools a priority and really encouraged them, gave a lot of money for them, loosened up regulations, and we've had an explosion of these as well. Interestingly, this has had an impact on public schools. Many public schools are now creating single-sex programs in order to compete with the charter schools. School Superintendent Walter Mitten said he planned two new gender-based academies in Springfield, Illinois, to preempt expected growth in the independent charter schools in central Illinois. Now, the prospect of special identity schools that is enabled by school choice should prompt questions about the character of schools that the public should support. Should school systems, local communities, states, or the federal government establish guidelines to encourage or discourage special identity schools? Or school choice initiatives that promote self-segregation along the lines of race, ethnicity, or religion? The capacity of parents and students to use school choice to self-segregate is a feature that these programs could curb or promote. But it doesn't really get much discussion. The seductiveness of the choice framework makes enrollment patterns seem natural, seem the result of simply private choices. Ironically, given the history of Brown v. Board of Education, the only constitutional constraint at this moment on the creation of these special identity schools is you cannot use an individual student's identity to assign a student to a school, even if the goal is to desegregate. Despite the Supreme Court's rejection of the use of race in school choice programs in Seattle and Louisville, there still can be the use of residential neighborhoods and school siting and other kinds of devices to try to promote indirectly racial integration. And many school systems are trying this. California recently upheld a plan that assigns students to schools based not on their own races, but on the racial composition of their neighborhoods, and thereby have produced some racially mixed schools. But different opportunities for racial mixing would arise if school districts bridged suburbs and cities, the topic that's off the agenda, not even discussed. And we don't talk about it because we have school choice, so we don't need to talk about it. Who decides what kind of schools should get public money? When the Supreme Court announced constitutional protection for parental choice for private schools 85 years ago, school choice became an idea that now has developed many beguiling meanings. Announcing a fundamental right for parents to select religious schools or private alternatives to government-run schools, Pierce versus Society's sister launched what I've called a two-tier system, opening up private schools to well-off or philanthropically benefited families, and it also propelled decades of advocacy for public aid to private religious schools, which is now lawful and yet politically unpopular. School choice has offered an exit strategy for whites seeking to avoid school desegregation, then a strategy for voluntary racial mixing, and now a strategy for self-separation by race, by gender, by ethnicity, by language. School choice has altered the landscape of American schooling by dislodging the assumption that most schools simply attend the school in their neighborhood. But the borders of districts separating suburbs and cities, middle class and poor, remain intact, unquestioned. No experimentation there. School choice increasingly captures hopes as a mechanism for improving the quality of schooling, and I've supported it in many places. But unless it's carefully framed, school choice regimes open new risks of separatism and even new kinds of fears about people unlike yourself. Indeed, it may be easier and cheaper to differentiate and market individual school programs in a competitive environment by using identity markers like gender, disability, or language than successes in pedagogy. And it may be easier for parents to use the shorthand markers to sort through the choices, even if society as a whole would be much better off with schools that bridge rather than reinforce these differences. When well-designed, choice initiatives open up new possibilities. But if they're not mindfully designed, it's not clear where we will end up. And at stake, I think, is nothing less than the character of the society, the polity, the next generation. We may not notice, but choice itself is not neutral. In a diverse and at times divided society, the language of choice can look like a solvent of difference. It can diffuse conflict over collective decisions by deferring to private individual ones. It can avoid constitutional restrictions on government support of religion and government endorsement of biases by why? Allowing private people, private parents, to make their choices, to use public resources, to favor religious schools or white schools or black schools or all-female schools or schools that don't accommodate students with disabilities. When the Supreme Court upheld the inclusion of religious schools in Cleveland's voucher program, it wrote, and I quote, "If numerous private choices rather than the single choice of government determine the distribution of aid pursuant to neutral eligibility criteria, then government cannot, or at least cannot easily, grant special favors that might lead to a religious establishment." In short, private choice, not our problem. The plurality opinion for the court rejecting voluntary use of race to achieve racial mixing in Seattle and Louisville similarly reasoned, and I quote, "Where resegregation is a product not of state action but of private choices, it does not have constitutional implication. School choice may even come to excuse the stark differences in the achievement levels of students in different schools, because if parents can pick them, what's the problem?" These concerns should be coupled with the question, whose choices are we talking about? When is and when should the choice of a school be made by parents or children? When are the schools, not the family, making the choice, implicitly or explicitly, steering people in or out? Who gets the choice of a good school or even a great school, and who never does? Who chooses school boundaries? In the twisting story of school choice, aren't the courts the biggest winners in the choosing business, displacing the legislatures, the school boards, and the educators? And how does the frame of consumerism itself stamp individuals and the community into roles and identities that, left to themselves, they would not want? To think through these kinds of questions, I can think of no better guide than Robert Cover. He cared deeply about the project of learning. He used the Greek notion of paideic to evoke the purposeful molding of individual characters into a normative universe of a community. He taught that law is, and I quote, "a force like gravity through which our worlds exercise an influence on one another." And he said, "Narratives are models through which we study and experience transformations, the result when a given simplified state of affairs is made to pass through the force field of a similarly simplified set of norms." Our laws have made school choice a force, influencing the worlds of families, nations, cultures, religions, genders, sexualities, disabilities, and the narratives we tell about what we want for the next generation. Professor Cover pointed to the Jewish sages who taught that acting out of obligation is an even higher merit than acting out of choice. Now, that last bit is, of course, a sectarian view. This has a particular religious tilt. But it converges with social science research. Barry Schwartz, in his recent book, The Paradox of Choice, collects a lot of social science, behavioral economics work that indicates how increased choices actually don't make people happier. Instead, they divert people from reflecting on what really matters. We may choose particular options, but as Schwartz says, we never cast a vote on the whole package of choices. Robert Cover reminded us that central to all human beings is the search for meaning and learning how to live. He celebrated Pierce versus Society of Sisters and its recognition on limits of what the state can impose on meaning when it educates. And yet he also mournfully acknowledged that the state has limits, and the state's own limits mean that it must impose limits on particular communities. Education can be too insular, and he suggested at times at least we should reach for the possibility of redemption, by which he meant transforming individuals, but not just individuals, transforming the conditions of social life itself. Robert Cover emphasized that given the plurality of normative possibilities, the challenge is to maintain a sense of legal meaning despite the destructiveness of any pretense to superiority. And here, paradoxically, is the final seduction of the framework of choice. Choice may seem to avoid the pretense of superiority. You just choose. It leaves options on the table. School choice is just neutral. But it's not neutral. It converts schooling to private desire. It obscures continuing inequalities in access and need. It invites self-separation unless it is collectively governed. It treats the aggregation of separate decisions as free when the result so often impedes freedom and equality. The government and the people it represents are implicated in one way or the other, just as the government is implicated in one way or the other in allowing or refusing tax-exempt status to a university engaged in racist policies. School choice is not bad, but it's an abdication of public responsibility that's troubling. In sum, collectively, we all would be better off if we challenged individual schools and school systems to do better, to address the tensions between accommodating differences and offering a sense of home, validating subgroups, and forging a common world. Thank you.